Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So let's see. If this is Wednesday, there must be a Greek debt story, right? That one never gets old. Oh, and a budget story, too. That one's always good. Also, your letters on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday. It's the 15th of June, and you might have come across this headline at some point today. Overall inflation cooled a bit last month, and that much is true. But here's what the shorthand doesn't quite get across. What had been fairly limited and fairly moderate price increases are spreading across the board. Americans paid more for everything from cars and clothing to medical care and tickets to the theater or the ball game in May. Truth be told, core inflation actually rose the fastest in almost 3 years. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon starts us off today.
Now, should we worry about inflation? Up to this point, the Federal Reserve has factored out what economists consider the most volatile or temporary price spikes. But economist Chris Rupke points out so-called core inflation, a measure of broader and more lasting pricing pressure, is getting harder to ignore.
This is a little bit what the Fed was concerned about. They always said, don't look at the food and energy prices going up. Watch the core, because the core is more indicative of where inflation will be in the future.
So now, should we worry about inflation? Actually, Rupke, who watches the U.S. economy for the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi in New York, sees reason for hope amid these latest numbers.
It is kind of self-correcting here. Gas prices went up $1.25. We're back down 25 cents. So that's better than nothing. And the fact that gasoline prices have reversed a little is something that could bode well for growth going forward.
In fact, Fed Chief Ben Bernanke has been making the argument that this especially is not the time to worry about inflation.
At this point, he would rather risk some higher inflation in order to get better growth.
Economist Joel Naroff doesn't see stagflation as a threat either, since the economy is still growing, albeit sluggishly. He says Fed policymakers are right to stay focused on that.
They can't afford to have this economy stall because there's really no more bullets left either in monetary policy or fiscal policy. So they have to make sure what's going on right now works.
In other words, don't worry, but don't be happy yet either. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I can't figure out whether Greece is the economic story that keeps on giving or the little engine that couldn't. Maybe it's a little bit of both, because this has been a day of deepening political and economic crisis in Athens. The backstory, as perhaps you've heard, is that the country is struggling to get a handle on its enormous public debt. Prime Minister George Papandreou offered to resign today. Another general strike shut down much of the country, and Athens had its most violent protests in more than a year. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the latest from the European desk in London.
Greece is on the verge of bankruptcy and needs a second bailout, but thousands of protesters made it clear today that they're not prepared to pay the price in further cuts in wages, pensions and benefits. Commentator George Serapolis.
What they don't want anymore is further austerity measures that punish the people at large. What they do want to see is some prospect of growth.
But under the terms of the bailout by the European Union and the IMF, Prime Minister George Papandreou must deliver more spending cuts. It was because of growing opposition on the streets and in Parliament that he offered to step down today. Martina Stevis is with the Eleftherotypia newspaper.
I think he realised after a defection and two MPs from his own party saying that they would not vote with the party, that it would be extremely difficult for the government to pass these new austerity measures in Parliament.
Time's extremely short. Without another bailout, the Greek government could run out of money within a month. The IMF says it may be unable, under its constitution, to lend Greece any more. But the EU may soften its stance, says analyst Megan Green.
Probably EU leaders will have to come together with some sort of a second bailout. Otherwise, there would be a default, and I don't think that the EU leaders are ready for a disorderly default in Greece just yet.
She says if Greece defaults, the pressure will mount on the Irish and Portuguese governments to do the same to save their people from further austerity. If three Eurozone countries defaulted on their debts, that really could lead to the breakup of the euro. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Okay, so this is kind of a tortured segue, but bear with me for a minute, would you? We turn now from Greece the country to Greek mythology. Pandora went public today. It's a streaming music service that does all of its business on the internet. And we all know how popular internet IPOs are these days. Even though Pandora has yet to turn a profit, eager investors piled in all the same. Shares had a nice pop, up as much as 50% before pulling back at the close. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore examines how tricky it is to get the right price for new shares.
2 weeks ago, Pandora's bankers thought it was worth about $7 a share. Last week, they thought it was $10. Today, the company sold its stock for $16. Then investors quickly bid it up to $25. All for a company that hasn't even turned a profit. So what is Pandora really worth? As much as any investor is willing to pay.
It's about supply and demand. It can have great deals that just get lost in the shuffle because it's a bad day in the market. You can have bad companies get priced because it's so robust.
That's Peter Keyes. He's an investment banker with Baird in Milwaukee. Companies hire him to coordinate their stock market trading debuts. He and his team will go on roadshows, and they'll meet about 70 to 100 big investors in one-hour chunks over a few weeks. Here's how he describes those meetings.
To a certain extent, it's a game of poker.
That's because bankers have to balance what the company wants with what investors want. Brett Paschke is an investment banker with William Blair in Chicago. He says the ideal demand will result in a price pop of about 10 to 15% on the first day. That makes the company look popular, and it rewards shareholders for the risks that they've taken.
You're asking the institutional investors to invest in a company that has no public track record versus, you know, the 10,000 public stocks they already have the opportunity to invest in.
But Paschke says anything more than 15% is a waste for the company.
What we're trying to do is, in fact, predict the pop. If you have a 50% pop on the first day, you probably have priced it too low.
A big pop can also set a company up for disappointment. The stock price of social networking site LinkedIn nearly doubled on its first trading day. Since then, it's lost a fifth of its value. That's why bankers call the process more of an art than a science. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Pandora was one of the few winners on Wall Street today. Greece helped all three major indices take a big, big slide. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Vice President Joe Biden and a group of congressional negotiators sat down once again today to work on the debt limit. They promised to have a deal by July the 1st that'll let the Treasury Department borrow more money. The House, meanwhile, is working on spending bills for the fiscal 2012 budget. They've already passed a couple of them. They aim to have all 12 done and on the president's desk in time for the new fiscal year, which starts October the 1st. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale drew the short straw today. That means he is on the budget story. Hey, John.
Hello, Kai. I guess somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, that's right. I will confess to you that I am shocked that budget bills are actually being passed.
Yes, and it's pretty impressive given that the budget process has essentially been busted for at least a half a dozen years or more. The Republicans' overall goal this year is to cut last year's budget by $32 billion. And the spending reductions that they brought up first to the House floor are relatively low-hanging fruit. It's going to be when the health and education and labor bills come up for votes, probably later this fall, that we're going to hear the most squealing.
All right, well, back up for a second, though. What has the low-hanging fruit been? What's gotten passed?
The first bill was for Homeland Security, and the cuts there were fairly modest, but they were made worse by the cost of the flooding and the tornadoes in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. To their credit, Republicans have tried to set aside about $1 billion for disaster relief. That kind of spending usually was just labeled emergency and got tacked on to the deficit. But offsetting that money meant deeper cuts in other areas, including for first responders. Like police and firefighters. Now, tomorrow's vote is on the Agriculture Department budget, and the opposition there is getting louder. The bill on the floor includes cuts to food safety and nutrition supplements for women, infants, and children, and it slashes money for regulators of commodity futures. And that means that Dodd-Frank rules on derivatives would have no teeth. But, you know, Republicans didn't vote for those regulations in the first place.
Yeah, and we should point out Republicans control the House, Democrats control the Senate, which is where these bills go next. What happens?
You know, the chances of passage there are just about nil. Mm. And that's why this impressive display of political will is likely to be all for naught. I talked to William Hoagland. He worked on budgets as a Republican staffer for 30 years. And much as he's hoping the House Republicans have put the budget process back on track, in the end, he doubts it.
To their credit, they're being very, very tight. And all I'm saying is the House is moving, but we've got the President and we've got the Senate still to work with. So I'm not as optimistic as maybe some people. Well, this will be the year that we'll get everything done on time. I'm not there yet.
All right, John, so spitball it for me. Where are we if the budget process once again seems like it's going no place?
Well, that leaves us with more of what we've been seeing the last few years, these huge stopgap temporary spending bills that pay for big chunks of the government. They run thousands of pages. They come to the floor with short deadlines. No one really has a chance to read what's in them. And it means members of Congress can sneak in lots of pork. Unless the debt ceiling negotiations really are making some phenomenal headway, and they found a way to not only bridge huge gaps over how much to spend, but they also have reached some agreement on a process to avoid all this in the future.
And of course, those talks on the debt ceiling continue, and we'll figure out what those are when they decide to tell us, I guess. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale on the federal budget today. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
Forget for a second all the jargony terms we're obliged to use when we're talking about the federal budget. Phrases like debt limit and tax expenditures and whatever the difference is between budget appropriations and spending authorizations. Because pretty much everywhere except in Washington, D.C., the actual economy is about actual people. And commentator Robert Reich says they are too often forgotten.
The recovery is showing every sign of stalling. Yet 13.5 million Americans are still out of work, and millions more have stopped looking. And with housing prices sinking, millions more homeowners are facing uncertainty. So what's Washington doing about this calamity? In a word, nothing. Instead, our representatives are staging a giant game of chicken over raising the debt ceiling and negotiating furiously over spending cuts. None of this has anything to do with the current crisis. While it is important to cut the long-term public debt as a percent of the national economy, the last thing you want to do is cut public spending right now, when consumers can't and won't buy enough to get the economy going, and businesses won't create enough jobs without customers. Instead, we need to boost demand. For example, exempt the first $20,000 of income from payroll taxes for the next year. Recreate the WPA to employ the long-term jobless, and the Civilian Conservation Corps to give jobs to millions of unemployed young people. Let distressed homeowners declare bankruptcy on their primary residence so they can reorganize their mortgage loans. Call it a second stimulus if you want. Call it chopped liver. It doesn't matter. The point is to put money back into people's pockets so they can spend more and generate more jobs, which will get the virtuous cycle going again. Some Democrats say there's no hope of getting anything like this through Congress, so why bother? They're wrong. Tens of millions of Americans are hurting. Congress must act. Besides, the longer the economy stays in the doldrums, the harder it's going to be to bring down the ratio of debt to GDP, because the denominator of that equation will be lower. The president should use his bully pulpit. If Republicans won't go along with the jobs plan immediately, he should fight for it. Isn't that what the bully pulpit was built for?
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, David Frum assumes his rightful place in the rotation. Send us your comments. In the meantime, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, who are the real bad guys in the war on drugs?
I think that Mexicans get a bad rap, and while a lot of the stuff is coming across the border, it's our demand that's pushing it here, you know?
But first, let's do the numbers. Turmoil in Greece, turmoil on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials plunged 178 points, 1.5%, landed at 11,897. The Nasdaq down 47 points, 1.75%, 26.31 at the bell. The S&P 500 off 22 points, also about 1.75%, finished at 12.65. The price of oil fell. That dragged down energy stocks with it. Shares of Chevron and ExxonMobil both leaked more than 2%. ConocoPhillips sputtered more than 1.75%. Ford lowered its earnings forecast for the rest of the year. Investors hit the brakes, sending shares down 2%. AT&T CEO said the company expects to sell some assets to win approval for its takeover of T-Mobile. Shares of AT&T dialed down 1.4% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for May. The House Intelligence Committee holds a hearing on United States involvement in Libya. And over 200 feature films, shorts, and music videos are scheduled to screen at the LA Film Festival. Curtain goes up tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. I had a couple of really great Sichuanese dinners while I was in Shanghai last week, but I'll tell you, prices just aren't what they used to be. It can be downright expensive now, even to eat in a place full of locals. And rising food prices are just another sign of a Chinese economy gone wild. Inflation there is at a 3-year high. Food, gas, rent, you name it. Everything is more expensive than it's ever been. Certainly the Chinese people are worried about it, but so too is the government. Our man in Shanghai, correspondent Rob Schmitz, reports.
When government officials announced the new inflation numbers this week, they sweetened the bitter pill with some sugar. As Tsinghua University professor Patrick Shavonik remembers it, one official said, "Yes, we've got problems with inflation, but look at the bright spots. Investment in property development is a third higher than last year."
I look at that and I worry that actually, in my view, those are all part of the same story.
Shavonik says more property development has led to another kind of inflation. Asset inflation. He says these record high property prices are the reason local governments around China conspire with developers, bulldozing people's homes to make way for high rises. And that's why we've seen several violent protests and bombings throughout China in the past month.
9 out of 10 of them have to do with land and land development and land seizures. And that's because there's just so much money to be made. Now, what's happening, though, is that on top of that, with a slowing economy and inflation on the rise, people who were getting squeezed before are now feeling even more squeezed.
So if you didn't lose your property to greedy developers and corrupt local officials, you're bleeding money because the price of food keeps going up. That's the plight of the middle class these days in China. The weather's not great either. Dolly Dong stands in a downpour waiting for her bus, thinking about how much she's spending on, oh, everything.
I don't think the government has actually done anything to solve this problem. Transportation costs are really high, and that makes the price of food higher. The government should work on that.
Problem is, they are working on it, but inflation keeps creeping up. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This being a Wednesday, what say we check the inbox?
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
I've been away for a couple of weeks, as you know, and while I was gone, Tess went out to visit with the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, NACA, as it's known. They help homeowners adjust their mortgages and keep their houses, or at least that's the theory. Therese Hernandez-Cano of Los Angeles went to a NACA event last year. Didn't have much luck.
Unfortunately, the best NACA could offer me was a forbearance for 3 months, principal only, and then I'd have to file again for another forbearance in 3 months, but still most likely would lose my home. I was disappointed this was the best I could get with them, and I wonder if it's worth trying one more time.
Patrick Lee of Ashland, Missouri, was taken aback by something I said the other day about supermarkets and how they tend to drive what we buy. What I actually said was, what if grocery stores used what they know about us and our buying habits for good instead of evil? Here's Patrick.
Would you prefer dark, dirty, dingy stores with minimal merchandise? I love bright, clean, attractive grocery stores with thousands of products cleverly competing for my attention. Business isn't evil. Neither are people who use both psychology and common sense to boost the bottom line. It's called capitalism.
Well, when you put it that way. Finally, a response to yesterday's installment of Freakonomics Radio, in which Stephen Dubner and I talked about kids and how much parenting plays a role in their eventual success, including whether those kids go to college. Dubner cited some academic research on adopted kids and their education levels. But Rob Formica of Philadelphia says we missed some things in our analysis.
Many children are adopted through the medical foster care system because they have serious health issues. Children adopted as toddlers may have missed out on crucial early childhood development. And of course, the older a child is when adopted, the less impact the adoptive parents will have on the child's eventual educational attainment.
Send us your letters. Marketplace.org is the website. The link is the one that's up at the top of the page. It says contact. Forty years ago this Friday, the phrase, the war on drugs, first passed presidential lips. And since the days of Richard Nixon, the United States has spent hundreds of billions of dollars trying to control the use of illegal drugs and keep them out of the country. It's been mostly a losing battle. 22 million of us use illegal drugs every year, and that demand gets a lot of the blame for the never-ending supply that comes across the Mexican border. From Fronteras, a regional reporting project in the Southwest, Peter O'Dowd has the final installment of our series, The Drug War at Home.
All right, just go ahead and sign here, sir. And your initials on the side of the bottle.
At this drug screening center in Phoenix, a line of men goes one by one into the bathroom to pee into a plastic bottle. This center works with Arizona's criminal justice system to keep tabs on probation and parole violations. The lab tests several million samples a year. In many ways, the people here are America's typical users. Most are men. Marijuana is the drug of choice.
This is the gun of life, isn't it?
Executive Director Barbara Zuger has worked here since 1977. Sometimes she's philosophical about her job. Why in 2009, for instance, did almost 17 million Americans smoke pot habitually? Why did 1.5 million use cocaine? A survey of 17 countries by the World Health Organization shows Americans use these drugs more often than any other country in the study. But why?
Now that's a $64 billion question. And we're all trying to find out why is that. And until we find that out, there will probably be drugs and drug abuse in this country.
There's a ripple effect to everything.
Even drug dealers think about this.
Everyone that smokes weed is like a crack addict. I mean, that's their drug and that's their fix. They're going to call your phone.
I can't tell you his name for obvious reasons, but the demand for his product was constant. Before getting busted in Phoenix, he bought several pounds of Mexican pot at a time, the weak stuff, Bobby Brown it's called. He sold it for $60 an ounce and made about $2,000 a week. He sold to students, to firemen, even to military police.
I think that Mexicans get a bad rap, and while a lot of the stuff is coming across the border, it's our demand that's pushing it here, you know? It's like, stop the demand, you'll stop the flow.
Now this is remarkable. The U.S. government echoes the sentiment of a drug dealer.
Mexico wouldn't have quite the level of problems, and actually several other countries wouldn't have either, if we could reduce our own demand.
Gil Kurlikowski is the U.S. drug czar. He says the demand for cocaine has fallen steadily over the last few decades, but the government isn't sure why. It could be a combination of prevention efforts, like the Just Say No campaign from the 1980s and 90s, or it could be the billions of dollars invested in law enforcement on both sides of the border. For decades, there have been critics who say this so-called war on drugs is entirely the wrong approach. And Kurlikowski agrees on one point. The phrase should be thrown out the window.
We should stop calling it a war on drugs. People are frustrated. They don't see a real end result or a win. They know that somebody in their son or daughter in high school can still get drugs. And it's just the wrong approach.
Instead, Kurlikowski says this drug problem must also be treated as a human health issue. It won't be easy. Economists say very little can be done in the short term to stop our hunger for drugs like marijuana. Its use has remained steady for a decade.
Whenever I hear about the violence, I cringe.
This is a Phoenix drug user who spends a lot of time thinking about this very debate. She started smoking marijuana after a cancer diagnosis. Despite Arizona's new medical marijuana law, she doesn't have permission to smoke. She buys it illegally.
One of the guilt parts that I have over using the marijuana is what's going on in Mexico. I don't want to feel that what I'm having to do for my health is hurting somebody else.
And yet the money she spends on marijuana is more than likely fueling the Mexican drug cartels. All those little drug sales all over America add up to as much as $39 billion each year that heads south across the border. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from the Center for Responsive Politics. You know, members of Congress may complain about the Fourth Estate, but at least they put their money where their mouths are. The center says about 60 lawmakers own stock in 19 different media companies. Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry is the number one investor with multi-million dollar holdings in a couple of news organizations, including News Corp, which owns Fox News. On that point, by the way, media investing is split just about evenly between Democrats and Republicans. And that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 178 points, about 1.5%. The NASDAQ off 47 points, 1.75%. The S&P 500 slid 22 points, also 1.75%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, rising seas and real costs.
The estimates talked about losing nearly $2 billion in revenues every year if we didn't have Sandy Beach in Waikiki.
Surf's up or not. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.